You are listening to an American Free Press podcast.
Joining me on the line is Ilana Freeland, the author of Chemtrails, HARP, and the Full Spectrum Dominance of Planet Earth. Ilana, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
Is it okay? I should have asked. Is it okay to refer to you as Ilana or Miss Freeland? Which would you prefer?
Oh, no, Ilana's just fine. In fact, it's great because you say it right.
I practiced. I guess sometimes, you know, names can confuse. I know they confuse me. I remember I interviewed this guy for literally almost throughout the whole interview, I had a trouble with his name. I mean, I know it now, but I mean, he must have thought, what's wrong with this guy? I think sometimes names can mess people up. I know they do it to me. But yours is easy, Ilana.
Okay.
Now, I want to get into this magnificent book, chock full of information that everybody needs to know about if they're concerned about what's happening up in the skies and, of course, what's raining down from the skies. But before we do, for the benefit of the listeners, can you give them a little bit of background about who you are and what brought you to write this book?
Well, I've been a researcher for many years, and I know that's a sort of ambivalent term. I actually have a master's in historiography, so I am rather a legitimate researcher. But I turned my laser beam eye onto the deep politics, as Peter Dale Scott calls it, of the American nightmare that we have fallen into since my generational time, the 60s, and since John F. Kennedy was shot down in Dallas. So I had already put, 15, 20 years into researching America for a series of books that I wrote before I wrote Chemtrails and HARP. I had a file on chemtrails. I had a file on HARP. I had a file on genetics. I have a file on just about any major movement of our time. And I knew Adam Parfrey of Feral House, my publisher. I had done some work for him in editing when I was living in England. And when I got back to the States, and after I got back from down in Santa Fe, New Mexico, I contacted Adam and just went to meet him. And during our conversation, he said, "Do you think you could write a book on chemtrails?" And I didn't even miss a beat. I said, "Sure, I can write a book on chemtrails." At that time, though, I thought that chemtrails and HARP were maybe connected in the sense of they were both technologies that had to do with our sky and our ionosphere, our magnetosphere. But I didn't realize they were so intimately connected. And that came out early in the research as I began to go through all the old books that were on the topic in the least. I mean, right away, of course, I reread Nick Begich and Gene Manning's Angels Don't Play This Harp. I reread Jerry Smith's books, one on HARP and one on weather warfare. Then I did a lot of internet research and discovered, to my amazement, that major military papers were in open source. And so I began going through them and realized that what I was going to do in the book was disprove forever that this was any type of a conspiracy theory. And when I discovered that the very term chemtrails had been coined by the U.S. Air Force Academy on their chemistry course manual for their pilots in 1990, I realized that the military itself had infused the internet with this term that most people laugh at and scorn and try not to use, particularly in the chemtrail movement. People really try to use aerosols, persistent contrails, anything but this maligned word. Whereas for me, I like it fine. So we entitled the book Chemtrails, HARP, and the Full Spectrum Dominance of Planet Earth. And the full spectrum dominance, by the way, is not my term. That is a military term for a doctrine that they very much adhere to. And when it says full spectrum dominance, it's talking about the electromagnetic spectrum. And what they want is they want full dominance all the way from radio waves to gamma rays. Every single type of microwave, radio wave, gamma, infrared, blah, blah, blah. They want to be able to control it in what they term C4. And C4 stands for command, control, communications, and cyber warfare. I knew the military-industrial complex was involved in this, but I did not know how deeply the levels would go. And what I and Clifford Carnicom, who happened to be a close friend of mine when I was living in Santa Fe, and Clifford and I would talk about mostly Morgellons, because he's done the lion's share of scientific research on Morgellons and has even renamed the bacteria to the cross-domain bacteria, and there are reasons for that name. He convinced me that this full-spectrum dominance was going into 7 operations. Many people have commented on that's the real strong point of the book, is that I explain thoroughly how this is all about the military, and I think it's so amazing and yet understandable that all the discussion going on now about geoengineering, climate change, carbons, carbon taxes, never is the military mentioned in any of these discussions. And I think that tells the tale.
Yeah, and a lot of people might think that the word dominance, which is such a dominant word, isn't it? The word dominance would not be used in such a, some might say, crass way by the military. But there's a base down here by me. I'm in the panhandle of Florida, and there's a Corey Station Naval Technical Training Center here. And its actual name is the Center for Information Dominance, Corey Station.
In case you had any doubt.
Exactly.
I mean, it's not the word compromise.
No, it's not. I mean, I was shocked when because I went there and I said, geez, I wonder what this is. And I did the research. So it's actually the CID, Center for Information Dominance. What does that say, basically, right?
The CID, yes.
Yeah, all these alphabet agencies. So here's my, obviously I'm no expert on chemtrails. Your book, as I mentioned in the introduction, is chock full of information. And if anybody is interested in chemtrails, I would strongly suggest that you pick up the book. Because really, it's kind of like everything you ever wanted to know about chemtrails but were afraid to ask. When you read it, I did. You got to sit by a computer and follow along on the internet. And that's very important to do that. You tied everything in so beautifully, and there's just so much information in here. But when I think about chemtrails, and I mentioned this to you before the interview, but I grew up in the 60s as well. I was born in 1960, and I remember seeing airplanes in the sky, how they looked. And, of course, I don't quite remember from my memory, but, of course, we have the internet. And so I just plugged into Google Images. I wanted to see what it looked like. I wanted to see photos from the 1960s, airplanes in the sky, because there were photos taken. And besides chemtrails not being there, or whatever this discharge is now, which we're going to go over, not being in these photographs, there was hardly any type of discharge from these airplanes. This is what I wanted to ask. Have there been any changes in aviation fuel or protocols that could account for the huge trails that come out of these airplanes now?
That's a very good question, because even among chemtrail activists, some of those of us who spend hours and hours and hours at this, there is argumentation going on about the delivery system. And one of the things that I know, because I've definitely studied it, is that the high bypass turbofan jet engine, and that's important to get all those words in the right place, because there is another type of engine that is used in military jets, such as the Growler jet that we're dealing with up here, is different. There cannot be contrails, real contrails, in other words, condensation trails of just moisture coming out the back, which up till now, I mean, we spent years trying to clarify that a contrail was not a chemtrail and why. And now it appears that anytime you see some sort of exhaust coming out of a jet, and it doesn't matter how high or low they are. It used to be that we would think, well, you know, what's the moisture content? What's the humidity? No, these engines, the high bypass turbofan jet engine is used in commercial jets. It's used in large transporters of the military. And so all of the exhaust coming out, no matter how long it stays, is chemical. And I would say that the researcher who has done the most thorough research, beyond belief thorough research, I might add, is Jim Lee at climateviewer.com. Jim has nailed down the JP8 fuel,
used to be JP6. Now it's JP8, and they are definitely putting chemicals into the JP8 fuel, no doubt. The question to other researchers is that the only thing that we're seeing coming out? I mean, sometimes you'll see two ducts on each wing spewing something, but the case could be made, because we're not up there to take the sample, that they're unloading fuel, and that is typical. I'm really sad to say, I was shocked when I found this out, but to land, they often will dump whatever gallons of fuel they have left so that they lighten the load. So is that what it is? Is that what we're seeing on the wings coming out? Or are those separate tanks that are filled with a chemical mix in various areas? I'm a real proponent of the Eastern way of looking at things, which generally tends to be both and, rather than the Western way of looking at things of either or. So I'm thinking that yes, chemicals are being added to the JP8, and every time we see some sort of exhaust coming out, whether it remains for just 20 seconds or is up there all afternoon dissipating into a chemical cloud cover, that works in concurrence with various agendas and various chemical mixes over different geographic areas for different purposes. Why not? They have both going. And at this point, I'm maintaining that's my position.
In the back of the book, in the conclusion, you say here, chemtrails are creating the chemical corridors for HAARPs electromagnetic waves to follow. Laid daily over all 28 NATO nations, chemtrails linger for hours, spreading out into cirrus contralis cloud cover in the name of weather engineering and amelioration of global warming or climate change. For the benefit of the listeners, chemtrails, as you explained in the book, is from that Air Force manual from 1990. That's chemical trails. Can you tell listeners what exactly is HAARP?
Well, HAARP is the High Frequency Active Auroral Research Project up in Gakona, Alaska. And the acronym HAARP has been very handy for all of us, because when Nick Begich wrote Angels Don't Play This HAARP and spelled it H-A-A-R-P, it really stuck. In chapter 2 of the book, I deconstruct Bernard Eastland's one of his patents, the 1987 patent for HAARP, in order to see that HAARP and chemtrails really work together. In fact, that much that HAARP was doing during those experimental years that it was up and running, and some people say it was running just from 2005 to 2012 when it shut down. At least the press indicated it shut down. But I'm so fortunate that I know a man who has worked his entire life for unnamed three-letter agencies and their military contractor corporations in building these towers like HAARP. He worked on HAARP. He worked on 250 others around the world. And because he has helped me to understand how HAARP was actually, it's really true, it was a research project. Initially, I think when I wrote the book, I thought it was completely a cover story, because there is a clause regarding using humans for experimentation that is a loophole clause, indicating that if it's a research project, then have at it. You can use subjects for the research and not have any consent necessary. But I now feel that, yes, it was a research project. It discovered amazing things, but the power that it had was more than they needed from one area for weather manipulation. And what Billy Hayes has told me is that they have retooled HAARP. They've been spending the last 2 years doing that, retooled it, digitalized it, put in new frequencies, and are now using it full on as a real weapon, a directed energy weapon, because it is a tremendous phased array. And if you want to see what a directed energy weapon might do, you might consider reading Dr. Judy Wood's book on 911, in which she posits not that HAARP was involved, she does not say that, but she does posit that all the symptoms of that event, of the death of more than 3,000 people, indicated that a directed energy weapon was used. And I have read her book. I have studied the many photographs she has, excellent quality, and I believe she is right. So I'm imagining, and I cannot substantiate this, but I'm imagining that HAARP has now been retooled into a full-on directed energy weapon of great power. But does that mean that we don't have to worry about these ionospheric heaters around the world? No, there are many of them now, and they are all around the globe, and they are working in concert with NEXRADs, SVXs, which are these big golf ball things that are on oil rigs offshore all over around the world, wind towers, the ground wave emergency network towers, the cell phone towers, because we can't do without our cell phone connectivity. All of these things are now constituting a web of influence around the world. So that when HAARP was it wasn't the only ionospheric heater. I will explain. I know what you want. You want to know how it works, and I will tell you that. But HAARP was working with ISCAT in Norway. It was working with Arecibo down in Puerto Rico. It was working with a variety of ionospheric heaters, radar installations on military bases. We have over 1,500 bases around the world. So all this time, ever since the Star Wars Defense System, the SDI, the Strategic Defense Initiative of Ronald Reagan, George H.W. Bush, and Dick Cheney, ever since the 80s, they have been building toward what is now being called the space fence. And initially, they had a space fence in the space, and the ISS, the International Space Station, is part of that. But now they have constructed and made a way for an entire terrestrial system as well to work in tandem with the space system. This is what the next book is about, and I am writing that now. So the way HAARP worked, the way ionospheric heaters around the world work, is that they zap the ionosphere with tremendous microwave or radio frequency power. And this stimulates the electrons to jump off of all the atoms up there. And that all becomes very active and ionized. And then that is sort of comes down into the earth around magnetic lines of force, which we can't see, but I'll bet you a bee can see it. I'll bet you a bee can see all the magnetic lines of force, millions and millions of them, coming down from our magnetosphere and our ionosphere and holding our earth in this wonderful protective magnetic bubble to protect us from solar flares, CMEs, from all the things that the sun, though we love our sun and we need that life force, it also, particularly the solar winds, can be very harmful to us and our electronics. So the military has been working nonstop to be able to control not just planetary weather, but solar weather. And HAARP was part of that experimentation, but all of that power that is generated up in the ionosphere and then sort of loops down onto our magnetic lines of force, this means that our atmosphere now is highly ionized. And the maintenance of that ionization, so that they're not using ionospheric heaters all the time, the maintenance to keep our lower troposphere atmosphere completely ionized 24/7 is essential to the military operations that they want to be able to perform 24/7. And that is basically what I call C4, the command, control, communications, and cyber warfare, to have that element of threat at any moment. So to do that, they have to drop endless everyday conductive heavy metals into the atmosphere, not just when they're building storms, and when they're building storms, they really lay it down, but on a daily level in various geographic areas, then it's caught by the winds, it's caught by the jet stream, and this conductivity is really their primary objective. Of course, they love to be able to control the weather. I mean, it's been a general's wet dream for thousands of years to be able to control the weather for warfare. But the warfare now is so different from traditional, conventional warfare. We are in another era, and we have entered this era very quietly, so that certainly the American citizen who, you know, is yakking away on their cell phone and can't do without it has no idea what all these cell towers were really set up for. And that's what I want to reveal in the next book. I see the Chemtrails HAARP book as being the documentation of something real that is going on, but it calls upon us to be able to perceive what is going on. We have to change how we're thinking of the world. We are not in the 50s anymore. As I say in the book, we have entered a space age, but not the one that John F. Kennedy had in mind. and we are in it. And we may be just collateral damage. Some people think that, oh, we're being targeted. We certainly are being targeted to be experimental vials and petri dishes and test tubes for a variety of things being piggybacked on the polymers that are coming down with the heavy metals in the chemtrails. But I don't think we're being targeted for mass extermination. I think we're just being used as guinea pigs. But what really they want is they want an ionized atmosphere for their seven operations.
When you say they, talking about the elite, like, for example, the New World Order type characters.
Yes, and I can be a little more exact than that. I mean, it's what Eisenhower warned us of on his way out, the military-industrial complex. I would change it to the military-industrial intelligence complex. But it's also the defense contractors, the top 10, have basically been running so much. Certainly the office of the presidency, certainly the Senate, maybe not the House of Representatives, because that's a very short term. And where do the bankers fit in? Where does the Council on Foreign Relations fit in, the Bilderbergers, the corporate families, dynastic families since World War II and even before World War I. I mean, all of the globalists is what I call them now, the ones who have found a way to make enough peace among themselves to really foresee global dominance, true empire. And I think that their number one tool to get all the nations to obey and pay tribute, which is really what the climate taxes will be. This will be paying tribute to the globalists because carbons are not the problem. I think all of this is about to be culminated at the Paris conference. It's called the Paris 2015 or COP21 for a universal climate agreement. And that will take place in Paris in December of this year. Everything is heading toward that because the technology I'm trying to follow and put on paper for laymen is the means to maintaining true, not just full spectrum dominance, but full spectrum dominance globally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you say here on page 12 that a real conspiracy is underway, composed of Air Force personnel, weather forecasters, civil air traffic controllers, pilots, media, environmental agencies and associations, senators, representatives, physicians, and scientists in denial of service and breach of duty to inform and protect the public. You know, I think about this stuff and I wonder, first of all, I understand the control part of it. It can make sense. I mean, this has been a dream for that tiny little minority of people who are dominating and who have dominated all these millennia over humankind. What is it going to look like when they finally reach their goal of having the sky? And I believe that vaccinations are a part of this as well. I don't know how, of course, but I know that as early as the 1980s, only about 30-35% of school-age children were vaccinated. And then, of course, George H.W. Bush took his marching orders and said, we want to bring that up to over 90%. Now it's becoming like an epidemic where, geez, you're not vaccinated? What's wrong with you? You know, you have to be vaccinated. So what's it going to look like for your average person? Let's talk about an American, your average American here. They've got the sky seated. They've got HAARP functioning. They've got C4. What's it going to be like? Are they going to be able to take anybody out at any time they want? Are they going to be able to hear exactly what we're thinking? How do you foresee that this will manifest itself?
It's very important to understand that when you have an ionized atmosphere and you have full control over satellites working in tandem with the ISS, with towers, with all these different agencies on the ground, what we're really concerned about here is not only what Edward Snowden revealed, which I thought was 10 years too late, but I think actually Snowden, and we may still hear it at some point, but I think Snowden actually realized what this space fence would mean, in which ionospheric heaters and chemtrails and radio frequency and microwaves would all be available 24/7 in an ionized atmosphere, is that we can be controlled into what the globalists will probably call a peaceful civilization. We can be controlled through our endocrine system, not just our brain, with frequency and pulse. Our 7.83 Schumann resonance of all life on Earth, we all resonate to the same pulse at 7.83 hertz. I would foresee that that pulse is going to be changed and that our life form, and not just control over us or taking us out if we're a problem, but actually a transhumanist, quote, enhancement, unquote, of the human being is very much on their minds. They would like to enhance some of our abilities, brain ability, perhaps musculature. They're already working with the super soldier. So when you look at this one thing, and I know many people, certainly on my Facebook site dedicated to the book, I see that people are thinking, oh, the vaccination thing, and then there's the GMO thing, and there's this and that, and oh my God, I'm overwhelmed. Well, actually, they're all sort of working together if you understand the chemical basis of it. This is chemical warfare and biological warfare. That's what this is. It's not just the Ebola coming down or anthrax traveling through the mail. We're talking about working into the human DNA and possibly animal forms as well with a chemical signature pulsated into us. So if there's anything that frightens me, and I don't scare easily, it is that this transhumanist singularity event consciousness is dominating all of this. And there is the idea of a few men becoming as gods and having full control, not just over the human body and the earth, but over possibly the human soul, certainly the human psyche. So this is why I work so hard. I have insight into this. This is not a matter of making it up or being flamboyant. This is real, and they are close. The fact that the Human Genome Project was announced, I can't remember what year, but they had done that already 10, 20 years before. So I would say the technology that most people know about, they are at least 50 to 100 years in advance of that. And what do I think? And you're probably going to ask me, well, what do we do about it? For me, my job is educating the public. And that is what I worked so hard at. I want people to understand because consciousness also is a frequency. We have to remember this. And to raise our consciousness by knowing what the evil deeds are around us and not allowing it to destroy us or depress us and send us to the big pharma companies to get antidepressants or antipsychotics or whatever, but to really take this on and look the enemy in the face, a sort of anti-human enemy, I might add, or at least people who have narrowly decided who is really human and who isn't, much like slaves used to be seen as subhuman. I believe that many of the globalists see us as just fodder and subhuman and to be experimented on. So this is what we need to really grapple with, is our own consciousness. Yes, I'd like to believe that marching in the streets and writing my congressman would do something, but I don't think I do believe that. I think I believe much more in consciousness. And so my task, and others have different tasks. I mean, there's so many of us working on this. It's really wonderful. There's people working on legal possibilities. There's people working on how targeted individuals are being impacted by this technology. We are looking at as many aspects as we can. And I think that's why the press is coming down on people who say that there are chemtrails, coming down so heavily. I think they need to push this forward to get that Paris conference to rubber stamp all of this that we're seeing. And then they can really do some things. This is a 15-year sort of preamble to a geoengineered world. And once they have that stamp of approval in Paris, I don't know what will stop it other than a catastrophe from hubris. I can imagine that. But me, I'm going to keep on working for consciousness even after the Paris conference. It doesn't matter to me. It's time for people to awaken to the age we really live in. And it happened so fast. You know, in my lifetime, everything has changed. So that's how I see it. I'm going to go more deeply into that in the Space Fence book.
Yes, sadly, I would have to agree with what you're saying. Now, this conference, this is the United Nations Climate Change Conference, as you said, COP21 or CMP11, going to be in Paris, France, from November 30th. This year, not too far away, till December 11th. So it's going to be almost 2 weeks there at the end of the year. And this is going to be the 21st yearly session of the Conference of the Parties. That's what the COP stands for, 21, to the 1992 United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. They're pouring a lot into this climate change nonsense, aren't they? One of the things that bothered me were I knew nothing about this on page 35, at the bottom of the page. You say that throughout the 1950s and 1960s, more than 300 megatons, I guess that would be a million tons, right, of nuclear bombs were exploded in the atmosphere charged and radioactive particles, 40,000 electromagnetic pulses. I mean, they know that the different parts of the atmosphere are very fragile. And you would think that they would know that, right? Why would they be blowing up nuclear weapons in the atmosphere? This is all part of the plan?
Oh, yes. Yes. I think they certainly detonated the Van Allen belts over and over and over again in the 50s. I had a moment of satisfaction in Santa Fe when I went to hear a Los Alamos National Labs guy give a talk, and he asked if there were questions, and I raised my hand and very innocently said, but tell me, why is it that you detonated so many nuclear bombs in the Van Allen belts in the 1950s? And I thought his face turned red, and I thought he was apoplectic or something, because he simply was not ready for that question. He said, I know nothing about that, and he moved quickly on. I think that radiation is very interesting to them in order to see its effects on life forms and its effect on the atmosphere. They've sent some into the sun, as far as I know. It's like the latest toy. And as far as the fallout from it, to them, I think that's just experimental information. I don't think these people are like you and me at all. They are willing to sacrifice their families. They are willing to sacrifice themselves for the sake of their vision. Not the ones at the bottom who are interested in power and money, but the ones at the top, they are very committed to their vision. And they prepare their sons and their daughters to carry the torch beyond their own lifetimes. These are people who are committed. And what I would like to see on our level among the people, that we would have a similar commitment to oppose these visions. This is what we need. We don't need more fear. We don't need knee-jerk assumptions and drawing conclusions based on nothing. We need to think. We need to really take hold of this and explore it. And that was what I tried to do in the book. I mean, it was an overkill with 600 footnotes, I realize, but I really wanted to give people plenty so that they could research on their own.
Right.
And part of it was selfish to not bother me with teeny weeny questions, but to really do some work. And that's hard for people because over 50 years now, we have been weakened by television and the cognitive dissonance that it has created in our psyche. And we must push against that. That sleepiness, that fear, whatever, the inability to listen to something which is not pleasant and to then sink into a depression. We've got to get a little stronger here. And that's what I hope. And that's why I do these radio interviews, is to appeal to people. Please, please help us. This is big. And it's coming quietly on cat paws. And that is generally how it happens. This is the second Manhattan Project, as Peter Kirby recently said on a radio interview on Coast to Coast. Yes, this is the second Manhattan Project, and it will be written of in the future, 50 years in the future. But right now, we need to learn now because of our children, our grandchildren, the people around us. We need to know where we're living and what is really going on.
You know, it reminds me of one of my favorite books that was written, 105 years ago, a little more than 105 years ago. One of my favorite authors, E.M. Forster, he wrote that novella, The Machine Stops. I don't know if you've ever read that.
No, I didn't read it.
Wonderful. I'm reading this. So the story is set in a post-apocalyptic world where people are living underground because the surface is uninhabitable and they rely on a giant machine to provide their needs. So Forster foresaw what was going to happen. I remember one of the parts of that book, and I read that in college decades ago, but he had mentioned that the one thing that humankind could not do at that point was to control the weather. They had tried, but they weren't able to do it. So the earth became a disaster. Everybody went underground. For the little bit I know about this, relative to what you have put together here, which is magnificent, I think that this is something that is happening. And the way that they're doing it now, the speed that they're doing it with, not just the speed, but the way that they're doing it, the almost hyperactivity of the vaccines, of just about everything. Everything's moving so fast that it has to be done. And if you don't agree with it, then you're an enemy. And sadly, again, going back to what I was saying, watching the planes as we were innocent kids up in the sky, and there is nothing like this, like it looks now. You look up in the sky some days and you've got these trails crisscrossing and it's covering the whole sky. People do need to wake up. I've said this over and over again in my interviews. I haven't watched TV going on 20 25 years, and I think it's something that people just have to give up. They just have to say, I don't really need that. It doesn't really serve much of a purpose. You can go on the internet and watch videos and see whatever you need to see. Or better yet, you can read. And again, for the person who's interested in chemtrails, as I said, I knew nothing about it. I feel like I did get a great lesson from your book, Chemtrails, HAARP, and the Full Spectrum Dominance of Planet Earth. When's the next book coming out?
Well, I'm aiming for fall. It's a little overwhelming because technically I will reach my limit in this book. Some scientific friends who are there to support me and explain things to me don't agree, but I do feel this will take me to the very edge. But I am going to go into areas that I did not touch in the last book, and certainly that will include exotic propulsion systems. It will include mind control, targeting individuals. There are so many aspects to these seven operations of the military, and I'm going to go more deeply into the ones that really concern me, including genetics.
Wonderful. Folks, pick up the book, Chemtrails, HAARP, and the Full Spectrum Dominance of Planet Earth by Ilana Freeland. It's 272 pages. Like I said, if this is something that you're interested in, this is the book. I mean, it has everything in here for chemtrails, everything put together. What a great book. What a genius of an author here that I had the pleasure of spending some time with. Ilana, I want to thank you so much for that time that you spent explaining all this to the listeners. And I'm really looking forward to the next time we can speak.
Well, you're very kind. Thank you, Dave. Thanks for having me.